And now, here's Johnny.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Here is a bulletin. Here is a bulletin.
What is it?
Stand by, please. Stand by, please.
In Dallas, Texas.
It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. In the motorcade route.
Three shots were fired.
Three. Put me on, Bell. Put me on. Three. Put me on, Bell. Put me on. Three.
President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
Stand by, please. Stand by, please.
More details just arrived. Mrs. Kennedy jumped up. She called, oh, no.
It looks like to basically technical issues and all make our way down to the docks. Hopefully don't have to, we can do a little more than just limp out into the bay. But this is episode 40 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I am your host, as always, Robin Hood's Chief Communications Officer, Jaffe Ryder. Once again today, we're presenting to you the JFK Roundtable with our special featured guest, Rob Clark, host of the Lone Gunman podcast. We are also hoping to have a couple other people join us. They might show up here at some point and be able to make themselves known. But in the meantime, Rob, do we have you there?
I am here, Jaffe. What's up?
That's great. So, basically, well, thanks for joining us. Good, glad you could make it.
Right, thanks for inviting me on the show. I know it's a big time of the year, and it's what I specialize in.
Exactly. Yeah, you've got a whole podcast devoted to the JFK assassination history and so forth. Pirate Larry, do we have you as well?
Ahoy, mate! I'm here.
Excellent. Okay, well, all systems seem to be functioning and in relative order, so I think the show may be a go. We had been experiencing, as was stated earlier, some technical issues with the streaming and the recording end of things. We'll see if we can work around those, though, today, and I think we've got some people already in the YouTube text chat area that seem to, right now from the indications we're getting, things are looking pretty good, so that's a definite bonus. Although we are getting a little bit of, once again, as we were saying just in the lead up to things before we went on live, a little bit of fuzz and electronic interference, it seems. Maybe what it sounds like is from your end there, Rob. I'm not sure if there's anything more you can do about that. It's kind of cutting in and out a little bit from time to time. I don't know if you have any idea what.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it might just be the CIA listening in. You know, you never know.
well, that'd be something. I mean, if we were really that important to them, and this whole case, this whole business of Kennedy's murder, you know, 53 years after the fact. But isn't it something? Isn't it something that, what is it? What, I mean, 2035? That all these records and documents have been sealed until that date? Isn't that the case?
Well, yeah. It originally was the case. But thankfully, to the JFK Records Act of 1992, that date has been moved up to next year. October 2017 is when they have to release all the files by. They could have done it any time in the past 25 years. The end date is October of 2016 is when they have to do it by, and I'm sure they're going to wait till the last minute to do it.
That was last month.
Or 2017, I'm sorry, next year.
Next, yeah, right.
Yeah,
okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, and that was thanks mostly, I guess, then to the film that Oliver Stone put out back in 1992.
That's right. You know, that film has been a big boon to the research industry. It generated a lot of interest in the case back then. It's the reason a lot of people look into the case now. Whenever they see it, it sparks their interest. It grabs their attention. And, you know, it lights something deep inside of them, you know, that gets them to want to actually take a look at this case again and dive into it wholeheartedly. Because it's not something you can just take a cursory look at and think you can, you know, figure it all out or even you know, get into it. I mean, there's people that have dedicated their lives to, you know, researching the case and still can't figure it out.
Talk about a rabbit hole. Wow. Yeah, it's just peeling back the layers of the onion. So just the endless hall of mirrors. Yeah, so much disinformation and confusion, of course. Yeah, it's... But I mean, you just talk about the king of conspiracies. It's probably, I mean, it's got to be up there, right up there with 9/11, I guess. Although, really, I think if you look at it in the larger scheme of things, 9/11 makes the JFK assassination look almost like small potatoes. Yeah, it's just a president. I mean, hey, come on, they come and they go, right? So, I mean, you know, September 11th was a
yeah. Well, some people would argue, you know, that the JFK assassination kind of sparked a regime change in our government, and that they've been in control ever since. And if that hadn't happened, then things like 9/11 would have never happened, you know, among other things. Because that's not quite the path, you know, that JFK and his vision for the future in America was headed. He was very much searching for peace. And that's not what the powers to be want. That they can't make money from peace.
So it would seem. And isn't it interesting that within the context of what we just recently witnessed with the election of Trump, that it seems, from the sounds of things at least, all indications seem to be that he would prefer a position and I guess what's known as a détente or just a more... more negotiable sort of diplomatic approach when dealing with Russia and Putin and so forth, and this business of the Middle East versus the neocons who for the last, what, 13, 14, years it is now that they've been waging war in the Middle East and elsewhere, of course, too, pressuring for all kinds of conflict and so forth. So any just quick thoughts on that as far as that whole business goes?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that that's what JFK was looking at too. You know, as a peaceful détente with Russia and a peaceful coexistence, and you know that's the reason that a lot of people hated him, and probably the one reason that got him killed. You know, back then people were very anti-communist. They were very scared of communism and. You know, there's a big Red Scare going on, and JFK was viewed as soft on communism. And, you know, with the whole situation that happened with Cuba and the Bay of Pigs, you know, he was viewed as weak, you know, in the eyes of dealing with Russia. you know, he was talking to Khrushchev behind the scenes, you know, trying to make deals with him to, you know, okay, well, you take your missiles out of here and I'll take mine out of here. And kind of reach a peaceful solution. But the fact that it even got that far to begin with and that Castro remained in power, back then and even to this day, is quite frankly amazing. But yeah, I thought it was interesting that Trump's comments, you know, that him and Putin can actually, you know, Putin's ready to come back to the table now. And, you know, he's willing to deal with Trump. He was not willing to deal with Hillary, and, you know, I can't say I blame him.
Well, yeah, that's the whole thing. If she was taking the position more, very, very, the rhetoric was quite, what's the word? Bellicose, I think, is one of the words you often hear the, you know, media throw around. So just over the top, a little extreme, and very lacking with the, you know, rather than taking a more diplomatic approach to things. So I guess time will tell, though. Time will tell, although there are some that wouldn't mind seeing Trump meet with the same fate and ends as did JFK. But then, of course, he does have many supporters as well, and people that are more concerned about seeing him protected and, you know, living out his term or even, who knows, maybe a full 8 years able to push forward and promote whatever agenda it is that he has in mind for the people of America. So anyways, let's, you know, that was actually, we got into things quite quickly there on that front. I was hoping to maybe save that for the end, but that's just the way things happen here, with the show on, you know, Pirate Radio Podcast. It's all very organic and spontaneous. So just quickly, hey, Pirate Larry, I know that you've probably got a few things you'd like to kind of throw out there and kind of, contribute to the mix. I'm not sure. Your father actually had a pretty interesting job, during that, I believe during the early 60s, during the Kennedy administration. Not sure if you really want to get into to that too much, but, is there anything you're just hoping to kind of, to respond or just to add to what we're kind of, discussing here?
He left the CIA after the Hungarian uprising.
Your father did?
After the failure of the Hungarian uprising, he left. And he went to work for the Atomic Energy Commission, and he worked on the nuclear non-proliferation treaties.
Right.
I thought it was interesting that, you know, George Soros, you know, who's kind of this globalist threat, you know, he comes from Hungary, and he goes back to some of the, you know, great upheavals in European society. And, you know, it's I wonder if these people really, you know, want to create that, if that's part of their agenda. I know I'm getting off topic, but any rate, you know, from the crow's nest, that's where I'm thinking.
Yeah, well, that's fine. That kind of brings us a little more up to date, and present moment. Something, as I said, I was hoping to maybe save until the end, but, let's see. Well, we've got a little bit of activity here going on at the moment with, Tyranny Unmasked, joining us. Oh, he was in Skype with us here. He's back and forth, in and out and whatnot. We've also got a few people, including Brig Denholm in YouTube, the chat area over there, along with Bathtub Jen. Pirate Joe 333 has just dropped by, so that's great to see the crew, convening and assembling, getting together here for the week. So it'll be interesting to see if there's anyone else that, stumbles in through the doors over time here. But hey, Rob, we're still getting a little bit of electronic interference there with your connection for some reason, just as you kind of might have something more just to do with your Skype connection, actually, with the way that you just, it's kind of connecting, coming in, coming out, kind of that sort of thing. So, you know, when you're basically your ID kind of box, your profile box kind of lights up and then disappears. It's a lot of electronic.
I'm not sure.
You sound good. Your voice sounds good when you come through, and actually when you talk, it's great. But maybe if you're not speaking, maybe an idea I think there might be.
You mean to mute?
Yeah. I think that would be the best. Larry, could you? Yeah. If just when other people are just kind of going at it here. So, hey, Larry, can you hear the same thing there with him cutting in and cutting out with the electronic interference?
There's just a little click here and there, you know, if you got some isopropyl alcohol, you know, spray the ends or make sure they're tightened.
The input jacks, sure.
The input jacks or stuff. But, you know, it's not ruining the show.
No,
I mean,
no.
We've had worse. We've had Skype warble, like, you know, people were talking to us from outer space. So, yeah, it's fine for the show.
Yeah. And let's see. We've also, you know, compared to the last few episodes that we've tried to run here, we've had, like, as was mentioned just in the lead up to things here from the outset, been struggling. All hands on deck here trying to get things in order as far as the technical end of things is concerned. So, but the YouTube folks over in YouTube seem to think that they're hearing a pretty strong signal and feed, so that's great. We've also got, as was stated, you know, earlier, we got Joe Pirate, 333, who actually is, we have to thank for helping line up our guest today, Rob Clark, from the Lone Gunman podcast. He was quite instrumental in helping to do that, working a little bit of a co-production sort of angle as far as the booking goes. So maybe we can meet later back in the Rogues Gallery and have a toast or two to Joe 333. But yeah, listening last night to your show, I've heard it a few other times in the past there, Rob. But just one of the questions I guess I've got for you, and probably a few of our listeners would want to know, is how long has your show been in place? How many guests have you had on board? And just give us a bit of an overview to things, the way that you, some of your just general impressions, with the way perhaps you, where you see, present state of, 53 years after the fact, there's a lot of ground that's been tread. So, but just, you know, think of the cottage industry that's been created over the years, all the hundreds, if not thousands of books, numerous documentaries and so forth. But just right at the top, I guess, tell us a little bit more about your podcast.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing it for about 2.5 years now. I created it out of the need to specifically get some of this stuff out of my brain from having looked at it for so long. And not having really anyone to talk to in my personal life about it, because, you know, it's kind of a specific interest, you know. A lot of people don't really know a lot about it or care. But I have found a very open community online that enjoys hearing about it and talking about it as well. I've got, let's see, about 130 shows in the tank. And still going strong.
Wow, 130 shows. Who are some of the top? Who are some of your favorite guests that you've had come, join you?
I don't really have a lot of big names. I try to stick with people that are doing actual research, and I like to talk to them about their work. You know, a lot of folks kind of have. The big authors come on and promote their books and this and that. And I kind of stick like a level below that.
Right.
Just people kind of like myself, not really big name people. But they're doing some really good work in the case. Guys like, Bart Camp, he's from England. He's from the ROKC forum and, prayer-man.com. They're part of these guys that are really looking into this, image of the prayer man, and we can get into that later if you'd like to. But there's some research going on right now as we speak about this mysterious figure caught on some film that they believe is Lee Oswald, which would mean that he's not on the sixth floor shooting. Folks like that, you know, just normal, average, everyday guys. I had a filmmaker on the show. He did a movie called The Searchers that's being shown at Lancer in Dallas tomorrow or today, depending on where you are, at the conference down there. And, you know, just folks like that. Nobody huge, but, you know, I like to go after the interesting folks, people that are doing stuff.
That's what we kind of do too. That's our focus as well. You know, as much as we love people like bigger names just straight across the board, whether it's like Michael Tesserian, Jim Mars, speaking of, you know, JFK research and the like, but Graham Hancock, I mean, just to name a few, David Icke, we feel that these people have, by and large, received enough attention and exposure as it is. And our focus, pretty much maybe, you know, along the lines of what you're getting at there too, is just really to focus on promoting and supporting the up and comers or people at the grassroots and more kind of in the underground and in some ways too, is that giving them the opportunity, giving them a chance, presenting them with a forum and a platform where they can have their voices heard and get their stories out there. So yeah, that's great though. And that's one of the reasons why we've got you here today and that we didn't try to get a hold of Jim Mars, you know, as great as he is and as good as, you know, as much, you know, great work that he's done on the whole issue of JFK over the years. So yeah, but that's great. Now, there's some of the, now why don't we talk about the prayer man then? I mean, we could get into that. Although let me just throw a couple, there's a couple names I'm going to throw out here for, cause I was, like I said, was, you know, I've listened to some of your shows in the past and then just last night, over the course of the evening, the couple of names that really jumped out at me were some of your biggest, the people that you're really a big cheerleader for. A couple of names are Jim Fetzer and Judith Ferry Baker. You love those two, don't you?
Yeah. I don't know if love is the right word. Something I try to do on my show and part of my mantra and my tagline is where research comes to shine and myths come to die. Because look, if you put everybody in Dealey Plaza that ever said that they were there or that they were the shooter or they know who the shooter was and where they were, you know, it would just be a packed cacophony of assassins and, you know, all these people. And that's part of the problem, you know, when you're trying to look at this stuff, is to kind of, you know, weed through all the mess and the noise and get to the core of the thing. And, you know, something I started a couple of years ago is just trying to pay attention to what could be proven and not really giving much credence to fairy tales. You know, look, Judith Baker tells a great story. You know, it's a great love story. And if she would have been a fiction writer, she probably would have been a best-selling author. But and the allegation, for people that don't know who Judith Baker is that she was Lee Oswald's girlfriend for a couple months before the assassination. And that she spent all this time with him, and he told her all these things. And for somebody that's attempting to rewrite history, and like you mentioned earlier, you know, it's become a cottage industry. You know, she's putting on a conference in Dallas as we speak. And she keeps putting books out, but despite these fantastic stories and these woven tales, you know, there's absolutely zero evidence of what she says. She's got no documentation to prove or back up anything that she says about her story. You know, we can go down the list, James Files, Chauncey Holt, Beverly Oliver, you know, all these people have great stories, but no proof whatsoever of what they're saying.
Wasn't Beverly Oliver, though, wasn't she a waitress at Jack Ruby's Carousel Club?
No, she was let's see how old she was back then. I want to say 15 or 17-year-old singer at the Colony Club, which was next door to the Carousel Club. She didn't actually work for Jack Ruby.
Gotcha. Now, here's the deal. Now, because I'm not an expert. That's why we got people like you come drop by and visit us. But my understanding of with the big claim to fame with Beverly Oliver is that supposedly she was in Dealey Plaza. She was right there on the scene. And that she, a few days later, had her film and maybe just the whole camera and everything, confiscated by a couple of spooks, basically. I'm not sure if they're like FBI or local police or what have you, but they have, so according to her story, what I've heard, is that they confronted her in the at the club and demanded that she hand this her camera and film over. Is that the story, more or less, that you've heard?
Yeah, that's basically the story, but once again, it's a story. There's absolutely zero proof that she was in Dealey Plaza that day. If you look at the pictures of the babushka lady captured on film from that day, it does appear to be a heavier set older woman than a, you know, teenage girl, even dressed more like a middle-aged woman than a teenage girl would dress on a warm November day. And as far as the camera, it's been alleged that the camera that she had was a prototype not available to the public for, I believe it was 4 more years. So there's all kinds of problems with her story. You know, she even says that a CIA agent and an FBI agent came to take her film and introduce themselves as such. You know, hi, I'm Rob Clark from the CIA.
Yeah.
And we need your film.
Which, and she was worried about that. She was happy to hand it over because she was more worried at that time about them finding her, the little stash of weed she had in her purse, apparently. She had some pot. So, but hang on. So this is something. So she claims to have been the babushka lady?
Yes.
Jeez. Yes. Okay. Well, that I did not know. I've never heard. Like, that doesn't, I mean, what was she going incognito on the day or something? That, obviously, it looks like my grandmother or something, the way she looked when she was about 60 or something, you know? So, yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you apply a little logic and reasoning to some of these claims that these people make.
That's just total nonsense. I can't believe that she claims that. I had no idea. Like, oh, yeah, that's just ridiculous. And because she was like, what, you said 17, 18? She was, you know, was a young little thing.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah, very young.
But, okay, well, this is something. How about that?
And that's not all she's claimed either. She's claimed... She claimed she met Lee Oswald in Jack Ruby's club before the assassination, and he was introduced to her as, this is Lee Oswald from the CIA.
Which, of course, that's the way they go about doing this. You always want to be really upfront with your connection and your affiliation to the company, right? You know, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hi. I'm, yeah.
The way she came forward, you know, there's a problem, I think, with this case, with certain researchers who wanted desperately to have their name connected to the case. And we've seen it time after time over the years where researchers will try to bring forward a witness. We saw it with this whole Roscoe White fiasco in the early 90s, and with James Files in the 90s. The same people were behind both of them coming out, and both stories turned out to be false. And
Roscoe White, you were breaking up there a little bit. You said Roscoe White?
Yeah, Roscoe White.
Now, James Files, he's I'm not sure if he's passed away yet or not. He was locked up for one reason or another. But there's video of him that you can find on YouTube. Anyone who's interested in taking a look at that, just type in James Files, JFK, shooter, and you'll be able to probably track down whatever is that all that he has to say on the matter. But Roscoe White, where does he fit into the picture?
Well, Roscoe White's an interesting story for sure. He was in the Marines at the same time Oswald was. He is from Texas, and he actually came back out of the Marine Corps, I believe, in early 63, and he got a job with the Dallas Police Department in, I believe, September of 1963. Now, the claim from Roscoe White is that he was actually working undercover for the CIA and that he was the assassin on the grassy knoll. And he had these wired documents, you know, with his code name that was Mandarin, letting him know what his instructions were as far as to who to kill. And that after the assassination, he had a cleanup list of witnesses that he was to take out. Funny thing is, he ended up dying in the early 70s in a welding accident. He was welding on a table with a bunch of chemicals underneath of it, and it kind of went kaboom and burned him up real bad. But when he was in the hospital, the claim is that he was talking to his priest and made all these confessions, and then he locked away his proof. And the whole thing coming out in the 90s was his son and his ex-wife. And his ex-wife was Geneva White, and she was actually a dancer for Jack Ruby. So there is kind of a connection here. But their claim of the Roscoe White diary, when it came back out in the early 90s from with a researcher by the name of Joe West, was that they had this diary and that the FBI had taken it. Or taking all the evidence and never gave it back to them. But they had this diary, and it was actually proven to be fake and in Geneva White's handwriting. So that didn't go over too well. They even held a giant press conference about it. You know, you can find pictures of it on YouTube if you Google Ricky White JFK. Right after the movie came out, and it was a big to-do, and it just kind of fizzled really good. But like I said, a lot of these researchers, especially the earlier ones, you see them bringing people forward. And a lot of that is, hey, we can put you close by. It'd be great if we had a story, and, we can make money off of this, book deals, movie deals, et cetera. And they'll latch on to people. And, next thing you know, everything's been debunked and they've been, kind of put back in their place. But it's part of the cottage industry.
Okay. So here's a question for you then. I'm not sure where you stand exactly. I'm just not too clear on that at this point. But do you believe there was a conspiracy, or that's simply that Oswald acted alone, that he was the lone nut assassin?
Well, I've waffled quite a bit over the years. I do believe there was a conspiracy. I am a conspiracy realist. And, the CIA, when talking about this case, first coined the term conspiracy theorist, give folks who didn't believe in the official story a bad name. And that's all on documents and everything else. There's so much wrong with the case, and I don't know if it's a problem that results from the investigation, because it was a mess back then. You had the DPD, the Dallas Police Department, doing the initial investigation, and then the FBI steps in and kind of takes everything. They want all the evidence. They want, all the interviews with the people, so they got to redo them. Well, then the Warren Commission comes along, and they want the FBI, all the FBI's evidence, and they want them to go back and do certain things. So I don't know if it's a result of, just pure ineptness and just the craziness that was going on back then. But, I know my show is titled The Lone Gunman. It's meant to be ironic in its nature, referring to me as the only one, only host on the show. But I do believe in a conspiracy. The question is which one? Because there is a ton of theories out there. You can speculate all day about what happened. It's I think part of the problem, and what I've been focused on the past 2 years is what can we prove? If this thing was to ever go back to court, what could we prove? Hearsay is one thing. Fairy tales are one thing. But what can we prove?
There's even a theory that has gained some traction as of late. It seems that, and I think, the author here is named Michael Salah. One of the books that he's put out is Kennedy's Last Stand, Eisenhower, UFOs, MJ-12, and JFK's Assassination. So what of the belief, the theory, these allegations that Kennedy was killed because of what he knew regarding UFOs and the world of ETs?
Well, here's the thing. Apparently, there's certainly stories out there of, him visiting clandestinely some of these bases, but, you know, of course, none of that can be proven. What can be proven is in the documentation that we have of his correspondence with the CIA asking for certain things, any and all documents pertaining to unidentified flying objects. Once again, we go to the Russians because he wanted to be able to assure the Russians, you know, in the case of a potential nuclear war of these, he was worried about these unidentified flying objects, being the possible start of this. You know, he didn't want these things showing up over Russia and Russia thinking that, oh, it's us and them firing their missiles and vice versa. So it was in the conversation and it was certainly asked. We do have the documents from the White House inquiring to the CIA about their UFO files and if JFK could have them. And this was actually 2 weeks before his assassination. So I don't think it had a big, big part. They wouldn't have had much time to whip up a plan and enact it at that point, you know, as far as him being the key to this disclosure back then. But, you know, of course, you know, Roswell just happened in 1947. These sightings were a relatively new phenomenon, even in the early 60s, as far as people coming forward with their stories. Really wasn't on a lot of people's radar. But it does play a very small part. And there's very interesting stories involving a man by the name of Fred Chrisman.
Right. Yeah, we had Ken Thomas on board, actually. I think it was episode 23, and he shared a lot of background and information regarding Chrisman, who, in fact, I guess, was one of the people that Jim Garrison had fingered as being one of the, I think he thought he was one of the three tramps, but also had, he thought that he was also one of the trigger men.
Yeah. I've seen that and I've looked at that. I think it was a misidentification of sorts. I don't really see the resemblance between him and the tramp that he was alleged to be. I think he was supposed to be the E. Howard Hunt looking tramp. You know, Chrisman's a very interesting character, and when you look at the lore surrounding it and what this guy was into, there is a lot of questions. And, you know, one of them is, was this guy part of the CIA? And we actually do have documents released by the CIA claiming that he was. And there's a guy out there that you may or may not have heard of. His name is Thomas Beckham. And he was actually in New Orleans the summer before the assassination. And he claims that his handler was Fred Chrisman. And he claims a lot of things. He claims he was with the CIA, working as an asset for the CIA back then. And he told all this to the HSCA. Now, he was subpoenaed by Jim Garrison, but in front of the grand jury testimony from Chrisman and Beckham both, they both didn't really say much in the way of anything when it comes to their grand jury testimony. But fast forward a couple years to the HSCA investigation. And what you have there is a situation where Chrisman is dead, Oswald's dead, Ferry is dead, David Ferry, and a lot of these other important players in the case are dead by then. And what the House Select Committee did is they offered Thomas Beckham immunity for his testimony, meaning that whatever he said could not be held against him and he wouldn't be charged with anything. And in front of that committee, he told a very, very different story than what he got on the stand and told Jim Garrison. And it's a wild, wild ride if you believe it. But once again, it's a story, but an interesting one nonetheless. And one that he told under oath, you know. So, and he wrote a book in 2009, which he detailed. It was a self-published book. I managed to get a copy of it. And he's still sticking to the same story today as he told the HSCA back then.
Well, who is this character exactly? Thomas Beckham? I think it's...
Yeah, Thomas Beckham.
Yeah, because I'm not too up to speed on his whole backstory as I would, I'd imagine maybe a few of our listeners are, but yeah, if you could just kind of just flesh that out just briefly.
Sure, sure. Well, Thomas Beckham was a con man in the old school sense of the word. You know, he was a grifter, a con man, a forger of documents. You know, if you needed a diploma from a certain university, or you wanted to be a doctor, or this, that, and the other, this is who you called, and he got you the documents. He claims that Fred Crispin was his handler, and that he was in New Orleans, and he knew Lee Oswald, and he was involved in these fake churches that David Ferry and a lot of these folks were involved with, and used for covers to raise money for the anti-Castro Cubans at the time. Now, if we look at some of the more famous pictures of Lee Oswald handing out leaflets in New Orleans, there's actually a figure in the background who looks a lot like Thomas Beckham. And there's a white guy standing there in a suit with his pompadour haircut, and he is kind of covering his face. He doesn't want to be on film. And this is where he says he was. He says he met Oswald down there handing leaflets out, and that after he was done handing leaflets out, they went and got a Coke. And he sat down, he was talking to Lee Oswald, and, you know, they were talking about what he was doing. And Beckham told him, you know, he better be careful. He's, you know, creating a lot of tension on himself. And Lee Oswald allegedly told him, well, don't worry, the chief has my back. Now, the chief, in this sense, was a man by the name of Guy Bannister, who was kind of in charge of, I guess you could say, the anti-communist movement in New Orleans at the time. He had his own private detective agency. He's very famously portrayed in the movie JFK by Ed Asner. Yep. And, in the opening scene, you know, where he's seen beating a fellow by the name of Jack Martin, who he thought had gotten into his files. People think that what Lee Oswald was doing down there was kind of handing out these pro-Castro leaflets was to, in order to out commies. You know, if anybody responded to these leaflets or showed up at these meetings, you know, they could immediately be put on the list.
It was part of Oswald's sheep dipping initiation, right, as well.
Exactly.
And explain to listeners what sheep dipping is, how that works?
Well, it's when you kind of make a person look like something other than what they are. You know, you have this guy who had recently come back from defecting to Russia. Okay, now his motives for doing that is that, you know, he stated he was disillusioned with the way things were in the United States as far as capitalism. And he actually left the Marines and went straight to Russia. I mean, he stopped back in the United States, I think, for 3 days before he was on a freighter heading to England, where he would make his way across Europe and up through Finland and into Russia eventually. On a tourist visa, which he ended up, staying over and kind of relinquishing his passport and his citizenship. And he wanted to stay in Russia. And they let him for 2.5 years. And in the meantime, you know, he married a Russian girl and had a baby. And then he came back to the United States without really much fanfare. But now at the time, you could also go back and look at the CIA files and see that they were doing programs like this, where they would use false defectors to get behind the Iron Curtain, because you have to remember, back in the day, you know, there wasn't a lot of information coming out of Russia. You know, we had to kind of get what we could get when we could get it. You know, the whole spy network, and spy satellites were just burgeoning then. You know, this is a time when the U-2 was crashing, you know, in Russia. So a lot of times the best information came from people on the ground. And the only way you get people on the ground is either turn them or send your own in. And, you know, we don't know for sure if that's what Oswald was doing or if he was just, you know, a disillusioned Marine.
Well, it's interesting. A couple characters come to mind at this juncture of the story. Carrie Thornley and George de Morenshield. Carrie Thornley, I guess, served with Oswald in the Marines. He even wrote a book that he where Oswald played the protagonist, and then of course George de Morenshield was I guess someone that Oswald spent a lot of time with upon his return to the States. If you could just quickly maybe spend just a couple of minutes with each of those characters, just your thoughts and any of the key points you think would be helpful for listeners to keep in mind.
Yeah, I mean, Cary Thornley is a very interesting character. He actually wrote a book about Oswald before any of this stuff even happened while they were still in the Marine Corps, because he found him to be such a different guy, kind of thinking guy, called the Idle Warriors. And it wasn't published until, of course, after the assassination and everything, but he was writing it back when he was in the Marine Corps. Now, interesting enough, Thornley, when he got out of the Marine Corps, actually ended up in New Orleans in a kind of odd, I guess, twist of fate, you call it. Jim Garrison had a real bad axe to grind, I guess, with Cary Thornley, who Garrison thought was one of these Oswald doubles or was working with Oswald, which I don't believe is the case. I had Adam Go Rightly, who's pretty much the Cary Thornley expert in the world, on my show, and just the fascinating stuff. He actually wrote a whole book about Cary Thornley and the assassination, and it's fascinating, and I highly recommend it. Now, as far as de Morenshield goes, he's another very interesting character. He was allegedly just an oil geologist who was likely, like most people in that position who had the at least part of their employment took them to other countries. Most likely he was a CIA asset for sure. Now the difference between CIA agent and asset is a big leap. People that we can prove work for the CIA, and we can prove a lot of them did, folks like E. Howard Hunt, and people of this ilk, there wasn't many CIA agents, I guess we could call them, but there was a lot of CIA assets, people that weren't officially connected to the agency, but that they could have plausible deniability if anybody got caught doing something. Well, hey, they don't work for us, we don't know who they are, but they were paid. People like Alton Ochsner, he was a very prominent surgeon in New Orleans at the time, the head of INCA, and he would travel to a lot of different foreign countries and report back to the CIA. He was an asset as well. It's very likely that in the course of de Morenshield's work, he got to go to a lot of these Caribbean countries like Cuba, Guatemala, Haiti, and he would report back what he saw there. Nothing crazy, just, hey, this is what they're up to down there. Very basic intelligence gathering, I would call it. And then, of course, what we're referring to here is his relationship with Lee Oswald when he returned to Dallas in 1963. And some folks refer to him as kind of a babysitter, much like in the ilk of Ruth Payne, maybe could be classified as. Probably someone to keep a close eye on Oswald, just to kind of see what he's doing, because look, this guy was a Marine. He threatened to tell our secrets when he defected to our arch enemy, Russia. Okay. And he's bringing a Russian wife back into the United States. It's not a stretch to believe that either the FBI or the CIA would want to keep an eye on this guy to see what he's doing when he comes back. It's not a very big stretch at all. He could have possibly been turned when he was in Russia. He could have possibly be a double agent now. He could, or who knows? The list is endless. So it would make sense that they would try to get somebody close to him to keep more of an eye on him.
Yeah, well, he'd been on the FBI's radar for a couple of years. In fact, J. Edgar Hoover had mentioned him personally. Apparently, back in, there's evidence of that, informal memos that he put out back in, I think, what, 1960, 61, something like that. So,
there was allegedly somebody using his passport.
The several Oswalds.
Yeah, there's allegedly somebody using his passport when he was supposed to be in Russia. There was a number of Oswald sightings or people using the name Lee Oswald when he was supposed to be in Russia, or he was supposed to be in a certain place in the Marine Corps. And it's a odd thing, you know. And people have written books about it, like John Armstrong. He wrote the book Harvey and Lee, where he delves into this aspect of, was there two guys, both named Lee Harvey Oswald, living these parallel lives. And it's pretty fascinating stuff.
Let's circle back around to that in just a moment or two. But first, let's give a shout out here to the listeners, people that are streaming the show live here in YouTube. A lot of things are really heating up there in the text chat with the question. Bathtub Jen asks the question, how did any of you guys feel about the television series 11/22/63 with James Franco? Danny Benton, I don't know if I mentioned it already, but Oliver Stone's movie JFK was based on Jim Marr's book Crossfire. Yeah, I think that is correct. Brig Denholm, Dr. Mary's Monkey is a fascinating story. And so on and so forth. So, Joe 333 cracking jokes regarding Judith Very Baker. Who doesn't love Judith? He says, love story of the ages, the serial Oswald. So she is quite prolific, I guess. She's like, she puts out a book every year or two, it seems, doesn't she?
So, oh yeah.
It's, you know, and myself, honestly, I just try to keep an open mind, you know, as far as all these things are concerned. One of the things, though, it's interesting too, to think about playing the devil's advocate here. You know, she was apparently, Miss Baker sitting down to, in the midst of putting together, I'm not sure if they're going to do it live or not, but an interview with 60 Minutes, I think is what the story was. And they, right at the last minute, she was shut down and they pulled the plug on everything and, basically it just all went kaput. So, that was quite something, right? At the 11th hour that they pulled the plug on that. Do you know, are you up to speed on that at all? Do you know what the specifics are?
Yeah. They pretty much at the last minute, had some serious reservations about putting her story on the air due to her credibility. Mm-hmm. It's got nothing to do with, the mainstream media being scared of her truth story. As it were, I think we all know here that the mainstream media does what they're told. And, look, like I said, she's got a fascinating story. And a lot of these people we're talking about here tonight are fascinating speakers. When you actually hear them in person, some can be very, very convincing. And her story had already been told in a documentary called The Men Who Killed Kennedy.
That's right.
And, you know, she had written a book, an early version of, well, not the love story so much of Me and Lee, but there was a book before this that, you know, you can go on Amazon and buy for $3,000-some-odd, I believe it's up to now. Very, very rare, not many copies, that she actually sat down with a couple of researchers and wrote before she got tangled up in Me and Lee. Now, you mentioned some of the comments from the YouTube folks, and what's up, guys? And somebody mentioned Dr. Mary's Monkey. Well, a lot of people point to this story that Ed Haslam tells about Mary Sherman and her death in New Orleans, and you know what it could possibly have been tied to. Well, what most folks don't know about Ed Haslam is that he actually wrote a book before Dr. Mary's Monkey called Mary, Fairy, and the Monkey Virus. And this was in the mid-90s. And guess who's not in it? Judith Baker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I actually managed to find a review of this book, and it's still there on Amazon if you go look. And using one of her aliases, Avery Baker, she reviewed 5 stars this book and was, you know, just gushing over what a fantastic book it is. Now, it's not out of the realm of possibility that she read this book and realized that, you know, hey, I was there at this time, and I could probably come up with a pretty good idea, being my background is in cancer research, which is not under dispute. You know, she was written up in the local newspapers as a young teenager as being interested in, you know, trying to cure cancer and, you know, doing these things in the science fairs and this and that and the other. That's not under dispute. You know, what is under dispute is, of course, her, you know, alleged relationship with Lee Oswald. But, you know, just the idea in itself of the CIA recruiting a 15-year-old girl to come clandestinely work in somebody's dirty apartment and concoct a hazardous bioweapon in an unsterile environment just doesn't quite add up. You know, when the CIA has at their disposal tons of scientists and research facilities where, you know, if they were to want her knowledge, the more likely route would be to get somebody close to her and steal it. You know, they wouldn't actually use her to do all this stuff. But that's just me being logical again. Something else people don't know is, okay, she contacts Ed Haslam after he's written this book. And she says, you know, hey, I was there. You got the story right, but you're missing a couple things. And she goes ahead and inserts herself into this story and the whole mix. And Lee Oswald, because he wasn't in the first book either, blows Haslam's mind. He buys in hook, line, and sinker, and he rewrites his book, Dr. Mary's Monkey. And that's what's out now. And then he helped Judith Baker write her book, Me and Lee. And, yeah, that's where we are on that. So you can't talk about one without really talking about the other in terms of entanglement, which is, you know, it's interesting, you know, but, like, it can't be proven. None of the stuff that they say can be proven, and that's the problem.
Okay. Going back to the comment section, Bathtub Jen had also, she'd thrown out a plug for Adam Gorightly's book, The Prankster and the Conspiracy. That's someone that we all actually have had, we've had on the show here on Pirate Radio Podcast. You've had on the Lone Gunman podcast, and I think Bathtub Jen herself just recently interviewed. So she also made clear that people can find that via YouTube. Just do a quick search for Bathtub Jen and Adam Gorightly. So there we go. Let's get Pirate Larry into the mix here. He's been, I'm sure, attentively listening to things up there in the crow's nest. There's Pirate Larry, are you fully engaged?
This is an amazing connection of a CIA operative on the ground. Now, wasn't there, I don't know, some pool hall owner or some bar or something where they all, you know, was kind of a central location or something where they all met?
As far as I know, are you talking about Jack Ruby and the Carousel Club or...
Yeah, the Carousel Club and our dear friend Jack, our dear departed old chum.
Well, and Oswald supposedly knew Ruby since he was a child. Is that not the case?
That's an allegation from Judith Baker, so take it for what you will. There's no other...
But hang on.
There's nobody else saying that.
There's nobody else saying that at all?
No.
But, okay, well, here's the thing. Who was Ruby's, or who was Oswald's mother? She was a girlfriend, was she not, to one of Carlos Marcello's car drivers? Correct?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Okay, I mean, that might be something you want to look into. You've heard of no mob connections through Oswald's mother whatsoever, then?
Well, only in the fact that her brother-in-law, Dutch Moret, worked on the docks, and he was a kind of a money collector for Carlos Marcello back then. But as far, like, her sister was married to Dutch Moret. that's the only connection that I've ran across, other than some tenuous ones put forth by Judith Baker.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's get back into the actually, I think, Pirate Larry, you wanted to ask a little bit more about the CIA connection to things here, and I think we'll find that in George, partly at least, in George de Morenshield's jacket pocket, I guess, when he was shot himself, supposedly, that the investigators later found an address book with a reference to one of the contacts he had. There was this Poppy Bush of, I'm not sure what the address exactly was, with phone number and so forth, but do you know anything, Rob, about who's this Poppy Bush character, and is this a total poppycock, or is this indeed the fact that yes, this is what they found?
Well, it's quite possible. I do believe he knew George Bush. We do have a letter that he wrote to him actually back in the 70s, asking for help about something. I can't recall the exact subject of the correspondence right now, but he was asking for help with something. And I believe they did know each other. He was probably in his address book and phone book. But you got to remember, doesn't necessarily mean a CIA tie. George de Morenshield was an oil geologist, and George Bush was an oil man. So they could have known each other through that circle as well. I mean, I know a lot of people like to try to put George Bush in Dealey Plaza. You know, there's a famous picture taken by William Allen that shows a guy off to the side of the Texas School Book Depository that does resemble, you know, a young George Bush. The problem is the same figure is shown in other William Allen photos taken from the same day at about the same time. Of these police officers, you know, milling about in front of the school book depository. And upon further examination, which a lot of people don't like to do any further research, they just look at it and say, ah, it's George Bush. It's got to be George Bush. The figure seen in that photo is seen in other photos, and it's quite clearly not George Bush. In fact, people like to point out, well, George Bush can't remember where he was on November 22nd. You know, that's got to be something, right?
Him and Richard Nixon, the only two people living at that moment in time on the entire planet that just can't remember where they were for some reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank God for women, because they got minds like steel traps and they don't forget much. And his wife actually wrote in her autobiography exactly what they were doing and where they were on November 22nd. And George was in Tyler, Texas, giving a speech at a Kiwanis Club luncheon. Yeah.
We have a picture of him, actually. He's there. It's included in the streaming slideshow that we've got there on YouTube. So, yeah, at that same time, or?
Yep. If you're having a luncheon, it's generally anywhere from the times of, I guess, 11 to 1, roughly. I would assume. Yeah. Kennedy was killed at 12:30. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you do the math. Yeah, he was in Dallas that morning, and he might have been in Dallas later that day. But at the time of the assassination, we just can't put George Bush there in Dealey Plaza.
There was a phone call apparently that he made, and that he wanted for some reason, apparently, according to some researchers, Jim Mars in particular, I believe, is who I heard it from, one of his interviews, that he wanted this call to the FBI logged and made part of the public record so as to provide an alibi. Do you know about this phone call?
Somebody that worked for him, a fellow by the name of George Parrott, I believe was his name.
Perfect for the fitting pirate ship. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. What pirate doesn't need a parrot? So George Parrott was apparently a guy that worked for him who was on the kind of extreme right-wing thinking of things. And, you know, was it to provide some kind of an alibi or something, or was it just a concerned citizen who wanted to report what he knew? Because, look, despite all the the threats against President Kennedy's life back then, I believe the most credible threats were coming from the extreme right wingers. And I'm talking about folks tied to the John Birch Society, you know, these hate groups, KKK. And, you know, we can get into that too if you want. But, you know, it was kind of a big deal back then if, you know, these extreme right wing people, had a very, I guess, hostile viewpoint, and Bush could have been concerned about that. But, you know, when you look back at things, you know, we have files from the CIA, internal files, stuff that we were never meant to see, stuff that they thought that nobody would ever see.
A lot and that hasn't
George
come out.
Bush, well,
yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Was not a CIA employee or asset before he was director in 1974.
Well, but then again, there is the whole business of the 1963 FBI memo tying him to the CIA. It was something which I think, was it written by Hoover himself or sent to Hoover? And then in response, George H.W. Bush, old man POTUS, you know, 40, skull and bones 41, stated that, well, that must have been another George Bush of the CIA. That was apparently, he's on the record as having said that. It wasn't me. It was other George Bush. So who that other George Bush of the CIA is or was, nobody seems to know, but what can you say in response to that?
Here's my thought on that.
Yeah,
I know exactly what you're talking about, and Hoover does mention George Bush of the CIA, you know, and my counter to that claim would be, how would the FBI know who's a CIA agent at the time? Really, I mean, because they were pretty secretive about their employees. Now, if he was an asset, they certainly wouldn't have known that. I would just ask for documentation, you know. It's a curious comment, but what would make him say that?
Well, we'll add that to the, it's always tough to speculate on people's motives, of course, so who really knows? It could be anything, but it seems to be there in black and white for people to, you know, to people to look at and reflect upon and just kind of decide for themselves what to make of it all. So we'll add that to the show links, of course, but, let's see. We've got so many characters here in this case. Another interesting and very colorful personality is Dorothy Kilgallen, who apparently she was one of the few journalists to actually, if not the only journalist, to have an actual one-on-one private interview with Jack Ruby. She claimed that following the interview that she was apparently going to blow the lid off the whole JFK case, and just a couple days after that was found dead. So, and that ties into the whole body count, the kill list as it's known. And maybe if you could just comment on those two things, Dorothy Kilgallen and this whole business of the kill list, and whether you could just chalk all that up to coincidence or maybe there's, you know, something behind it all.
Sure. You know, Jack Ruby is a very interesting guy. When you really look at his connections and, his ties to the racketeering and things of this nature. You know, he was running guns for who, I don't know. Could have been the CIA, could have been, just because he was very anti-communist. You know, he was running guns to Cuba in the late 50s. He had made trips to Cuba, with some certain folks and allegedly met certain folks while in Cuba. But, you know, he after he was arrested and when he was in front of the Warren Commission and talking to Earl Warren, he made some very startling admissions. Now, his original statement of why he killed Oswald was that he did not want Jackie Kennedy to have to come back to Dallas for a trial and put her through all this, that she'd been through enough already, and he felt that somebody needed to just nix that in the bud and take care of it right away so she wouldn't have to deal with any of that.
How chivalrous.
Yeah. The knight in shining armor.
Yeah.
And, you know, but when he was in front of the Warren Commission, he told a little bit of a different story.
But he never actually got to speak in front of the Warren Commission. They wouldn't allow him to go. They refused to have him come to the nation's capital. Instead, I think a few members of the committee or commission, the Warren Commission panel, they visited him in jail. Is that not correct?
That is correct. That is most certainly correct.
Gerald Ford, I think, was one. Maybe Alan Dulles. I don't, you know. So,
I don't think Dulles was there.
Okay,
but I think Gerald Ford was there. Earl Warren himself was there. And he practically begged them to take him to Washington.
Right.
He said, "Look, you take me to Washington, and I'll tell you the whole truth of everything, but not until I get there." But when he was in Dallas, he did give some hints as to what his concern was. And he specifically mentioned extreme right wingers and the John Birch Society by name in front of the Warren Commission. Well, as what he was being concerned about.
Also LBJ.
Powers in Dallas. Yeah,
sure. But also LBJ, very much implicated with the context of what of Ruby's comments. You can see that right there on YouTube. There's this famous clip of him being, as he's making his way along the hallway corridor, and very kind of cryptic sort of references to basically, he said, is it the man in power now, you know, the highest levels of political power? And he said, yes, that's it. That's exactly right. So it was in that sense, what he's trying to say is it's LB fucking J. So, and that kind of, you know, I mean, one of the things here too is like, Joe 333 Pirate Joe has, stated that Jack Rubenstein was born in Chicago in a haunted house across from Market Street. Chicagoans used to call him Jewtown. So that's an interesting sort of reference there, a little bit of a historical and cultural tidbit. But what are your thoughts then on LBJ, and particularly Madeline Duncan Brown, another sort, you know, suspect witness or testimony, someone who can, you know, their views can clearly, you know, be dismissed or can easily be debunked, or is there some credibility to what, you know, she was laying out there for people, the former mistress of the, you know, the usurper. LBJ.
Well, she was Judith Baker before Judith Baker was Judith Baker. She's a woman with a fantastic story.
She was not his mistress? I mean, so she was not his mistress?
Maybe she was, but, you know, when you're talking about relating a supposed private conversation, you know, that really implicates him as having some kind of foreknowledge of what was going to be happening, or being in charge of what was going to be happening. There's absolutely no proof of this whatsoever, except what she says.
Well, and this is regarding the meeting at the night before, supposedly on I believe it was Clint Murchison's ranch.
Right.
People, including, according to her story. And I think there might be other testimonies as well from other people that they were, you know, alleging that, Hoover, LBJ, gosh, I don't know, just the whole retinue.
Yeah, Nixon, Ruby, I mean, the list goes on, and it's an ever-growing list every time she tells a story. It's changed over the years.
She's dead now. I think she passed away years ago, but
yeah.
All right. But what do you think, or what do you know? What is your impression then of that meeting that took place, that gathering on the ranch the night before the assassination? You know, who did attend, and what did they talk about?
Well, I don't know. I'm not even sure there was one. And if there was, it's highly doubtful that LBJ was there. You got to remember, as vice president, you know, he's got, he can't just duck out and head off to another town somewhere without people knowing where he is, or what he's doing. And there's been no proof whatsoever that he's just leaving his hotel and his wife and going to attend this party on his own, or any Secret Service agents that have ever come out and said any different since. Now, when it comes to the whole LBJ did it theory, I got some problems with it. And look, LBJ was not a great guy, okay? He was a very, very bad man. He treated people horribly. He was a womanizer. You know, he was a bastard, for lack of a better word, to most people that he ran into. Does this mean he was behind the assassination? No. But some of the things that people try to tie him to the assassination are things like Madeline Duncan Brown, which is, of course, a story. Mac Wallace, who was his alleged hitman, personal hitman, who killed people for him. Mm-hmm. There's people out there that claim that they found his fingerprint in the sixth floor.
That's right. A partial fingerprint, Mac Wallace. That's right.
Yep. And guess what? That's been debunked. So, author Joan Mellon, a very prominent JFK researcher, hired her own fingerprint analysis expert. And 20 years later, using the most up-to-date methods and using, well, what they were working with before, 20 years ago, were photocopies. And all they had was Mac Wallace's arrest prints and a photocopy of the handprint or the fingerprint, the unidentified print from the sixth floor. This time around, she had Mac Wallace's Navy fingerprint card, his arrest card, and a crystal clear photograph of the print from the archives. And using the most updated techniques, and look, this guy, I've looked at him, his credentials online, his name's Robert J. Garrett, and he is very qualified to analyze fingerprints. I mean, he's the real deal. He's got a list of qualifications a mile long, and he looked at the stuff, and it's not Mac Wallace's print. So if you take that away and you have the fact that, you know, Madeline Duncan Brown is telling us a story that we have no corroboration or evidence of, and, you know, I went back very interestingly, and at the UVA website, they house a lot of the presidential telephone conversations that were recorded in the White House during the 60s and 70s. And I found a very interesting phone call from August 25th, 1964, between Lyndon Baines Johnson and one of his aides. He very clearly states in this phone call that he's really contemplating not running for president. Okay, in a couple months. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, he assumed the presidency and at the end of 63. The election was coming around in November of 64. And, you know, that's what everybody wants to paint LBJ as, this power-hungry guy who would do anything to be president. But yet, here we have a conversation between him and his aide where he's clearly contemplating not running for president because he wants the people to have somebody in power that can deal with all these situations. Because, you know, look, being president is not an easy job. It requires a lot. You see how these folks age in office in the period of 4 or 8 years. I mean, look at Obama, you know, it's really taken a toll on him these past 8 years. And there's a reason for that. It's a very demanding job. And if you kind of in over your head a little bit, then, you know, maybe you might be having second thoughts.
Well, here's the thing about that with respect to LBJ. I think a lot of researchers have pointed out that it might not be so much that he was, this is kind of a humility and modesty factor kicking in, but that he was facing potential criminal, very serious criminal charges with respect to his long sordid career and, you know, corrupt political track record, that it was finally catching up with him. In fact, had Kennedy survived to live out a second potential of running for a second term in office, that the brothers themselves, from what I understand, had discussed dropping him from the ticket completely and having nothing more to do with the guy, having him replaced.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. In fact, I talked to one of the guys who was working at Life magazine at the time, and they were all set to run the next edition of the Life magazine, which was had LBJ on the cover, and you know, and pretty much exposing all of his bad deeds to the world.
Interesting.
They had it set and ready to go. After the assassination, they decided that you know, America didn't need to lose two presidents in such quick succession.
It's like they say too. In politics, timing is everything. So I don't think myself, like, I would never make the claim that LBJ did it, but, you know, from my perspective, he definitely had a hand in things. He was a player, as was Alan Dulles, as were the, you know, various, this web of intelligence interests and players and so forth. The FBI clearly had a role to a certain extent, you know, as far as I can see. The mob, of course. Kennedy had a lot of enemies and very, you know, very powerful ones, too.
Oh, for sure. You know, and look, you know, the FBI had a lot to lose in this case. You know, if it was thought to be a gigantic conspiracy, and they dropped the ball when Oswald was fingered so quickly as the sole assassin.
Osama bin Laden. We got him.
You know, FBI, you know, J. Edgar Hoover in particular, you know, was always got his man, and never ever wanted the FBI to be seen in a bad light or a weak light. You know, and all credit to him for building up the FBI to what it is today, you know.
Well, do you know that it's interesting, over his reign of some, you know, 40, 45, 50 years as head of the FBI, that apparently not a single person within the ranks of that agency received a promotion unless they were a Freemason. If you were not a brother, you know, a member of that fraternity, forget it.
Well, it makes sense. You know, you gotta know how to keep secrets and network for sure.
And that's actually how we're going to close today's show out, with just a revisitation of JFK's famous secret society speech, which I believe he presented to the. It was the press club at the Waldorf Astoria in 1961. Maybe Mr. Clark, you can help get us up to speed there a little bit. But it was at the American Press Association, something along those lines.
It was at the press club luncheon, I think it was. And a lot of people say this is the speech one of them that got him killed. This and the Pete speech.
The what speech?
His American University peace speech.
Ah. And now, before we just quickly, we can just get the details on that. Isn't it interesting that it seems like for the longest time, that secret society speech did not make its way, like, to the, it was not in wide circulation until just a few years ago. People heard about it. Was that not the case, that for the longest time it just seemed to have completely been forgotten about?
Yeah, I mean, what's been around since then in some form or fashion, but when you actually listen to what he's saying, to me, he's clearly pointing the finger and talking directly to the CIA in this speech and their covert actions and their secrecy. And I think that's the crux of this speech. Because he wanted to destroy the CIA. He wanted to, in his own words, crush it into a million pieces and scatter it to the winds. He believed that they were a great threat to the American way and not part of a transparent government, which he wanted.
He'd come to learn about their widespread involvement in South Asian narcotics trafficking, opium and so forth, and he was quite, you know, pretty, I guess he saw how that could lead to things like what came to be later the Iran-Contra affair, and what we even see today going on over the past number of years in Afghanistan, the way that they continue to, I mean, gee, back in the Vietnam era, well, I guess what was seen occurring there were body bags, entire, you know, corpses being filled full of, you know, opium and what have you. So, and shipped back to the West and, you know, for distribution, throughout the streets and, you know, for the public to, you know, to the public to, you know, just on the black market, basically helped to fuel the black market. But, that's a big industry and a big deal, of course.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, Eisenhower warned us, you know, in his exit speech, his State of the Union exit speech, about the industrial, the military industrial complex, and he saw what was coming. And, you know, JFK, got a really good taste of it. And, you know, the CIA was doing a lot of things, and they weren't being totally honest, even with the president, about what they were doing as far as their political assassinations and leaders of other countries and overthrows and backdoor deals and, you know, installing, regime changes and basically to their own end, their own means and their own ends, not necessarily in favor of, you know, what the American government should or would be doing, you know, in a public light. And the speech that you're going to play, if you listen to it really carefully, man, I mean, to me, it sounds like he's talking directly about the CIA, and everything that they're doing and everything that needs to be stopped. And, well, as we all know, it's still around. And, a lot of these things that he, talks about have come to light as true. And, you know, what they've been involved with and, you know, you can see some of the stuff that over the years, like you said, you know, Iran-Contra and the whole thing with Barry Seal and, you know, they're running drugs in the country.
Yeah, MENA, yeah. Arkansas. I mean, the Bush-Clinton crime syndicate, that relationship between those two outfits, that goes back to, like, the late 70s, early 80s. There's a picture of Bush and Clinton, old man Bush, and with the future president sitting together there at a luncheon with, I guess it was former Alabama Governor George McGovern, is that correct? Have you seen that picture?
Yeah, I've seen that picture. I'm not sure who the other fella is, but yeah, you could be right.
Basically, so I mean, and we're supposed to believe that they're like warring enemies, or like, you know, that they really do have a problem with each other.
Yeah, Republicans and Democrats, you know, it's all one big happy family.
It's all a big club, and you're not in it.
Exactly.
You and I are not in the big club. So, hey, Pirate Larry, you had a question here for Rob regarding Woody Harrelson's father.
Yeah, so there's a rumor that Woody Harrelson's father admitted he was an assassin in the Kennedy assassination. And I find that very strange. I mean, because murder has no statute of limitations, so... I wanted your opinion on that.
Right, yeah. Charles Harrelson. A lot of people speculate. We go back to the famous pictures of the tramps. There were three tramps arrested that day in Dealey Plaza. Well, actually about a mile away from Dealey Plaza. But they were paraded through Dealey Plaza. And several photographs were taken of them. There was a taller tramp, an older tramp, and a younger fella up front. Now, many people have claimed to be these tramps. And many people have been claimed to be the tramps by other people. But I believe it was in the late 90s when the Dallas police opened their files that the arrest reports for these three tramps were finally found. And the original names of these guys were Harold Doyle, John Jedney, and Gus, his name's escaping me right now, Gus something, and that's who they were. When you look at the pictures of them, especially Harold Doyle, the guy that was up front, to me, it's a perfect match for who this guy was. Charles Harrelson was alleged to be the tall tramp. Now, we have pictures of Charles Harrelson from the early 60s, and damn if he doesn't look just like Woody Harrelson with hair, okay? So applying that to the picture of the tall tramp, it doesn't look like Woody Harrelson with hair from actual pictures of Charles that we do have from the early 60s. Is it similar? Yeah, he looks similar. And did he admit to being the assassin that day? Yeah, he did. And this is after he was put in prison for killing a judge in Texas. He also later recanted that statement a couple years later. So sad to say, I don't think there's a connection there, but it is interesting, you know, because the guy does kind of vaguely resemble him. The same tramp in question has also been alleged to be Frank Sturgis, who's another name that pops up quite often in this investigation. The older tramp has been posited to be E. Howard Hunt or Chauncey Holt, but you know, when you look at the evidence and the documents surrounding the case, that just doesn't seem to be the case. I think there was three guys in the wrong place at the wrong time that were brought in, questioned, and released relatively quickly.
What if the whole business of the Riley Coffee Company out of New Orleans and how Oswald supposedly worked there, and I think even that's one of the places where Judith Vary Baker once again claims that she was a fellow employee. Now, I'm not sure if there's – I think there are pay stubs that exist too. There have been photocopies or pictures, I think, circulating online of either him or both of them. But isn't it interesting? The story, as according to the way that the story goes, is that following the assassination, if I got my facts straight here, is that with that on the heels of the assassination, that the company shut down and pretty much everyone on staff at that location, they all got new jobs. Where? NASA. Do you know about that?
I don't know that the company shut its doors, but many employees did go on to work at NASA, which is interesting. Now, when it comes to Judith Baker's assertions, and, you know, Lee Oswald did work there, and she has pay stubs from her time there. The problem is, and this is above my pay grade as far as research goes, but other folks have looked into it and have determined that the pay stubs that she shows are not the correct part of the W-2, I guess, that is given to employees. Now, something else she alleges is that her initials are on Oswald's time card, which is, again, not the case. And, you know, we have testimony from other folks who knew Oswald at this time, and he actually spent a good amount of his time when he should have been working next door to a garage run by Adrian Alba and talking about guns. So, you know, this was the reason he was let go, is because they could never find him. They didn't know where this guy was all the time. And it turns out he was hanging out next door with his buddy who was running a garage over there, the Crescent City Garage. So once again, we have assertions, but no real hard proof. We can prove they both worked there at the same time. Yeah. But as far as it being some kind of a secret CIA cover job, you know, I don't think a coffee factory would be a good one to have.
Okay. I guess other people might think it would be one of the, you know, that'd be ideal. So I'll just make it clear too. We have a few of the folks that we, have you found over the course of your, like, you've done 100+ some shows with the Lone Gunman podcast. Not everyone, you're bound to, you know, not everyone is going to agree with the things that we put out there. Whoever it is, whatever our opinions are and whatever our position is on whatever issue. So, but have you found a lot of, you've managed to attract a few haters over the course of your time in pursuing this project?
Yeah, a few. There's two sides to the thing. You know, either you're a lone nutter or you're a conspiracy theorist.
No middle ground.
Well, no, not officially.
Right.
You know, the lone nutters, with the exception of a few, I mean, you can't paint everybody the same. But, you know, generally speaking, you know, they're staunch defenders of the Warren Commission version of events, and that Oswald was guilty and he was up on the sixth floor shooting. And anybody else that wants to disagree with them is an idiot and hasn't done their research and this, that, and the other. Now, on the other hand, you have, you know, the conspiracy side of things, and you've got 20 million theories under the sun. Now, of course, they all can't be right. We're all not going to agree on theory, speculation, or things of this nature, or who we think's behind it, or what exactly occurred, even down to the simplest thing. You know, you could disagree with another conspiracy guy about, you know, the magic bullet C-399, about, you know, anything about it. So there's always infighting, and that kind of detracts from, you know, the research as well, because, you know, look, Judith Baker at her conference, she's putting forth all these people, you know, with some crazy, crazy ideas, you know, about photo fakery and this, that, and the other, you know, that, you know, they were photoshopped Lee Oswald, or they turned Billy Lovelady into Lee Oswald, or Lee Oswald into Billy Lovelady in the Alton 6 photograph, and that it was altered, and he was really standing out front, and things can get really, really crazy really quickly. Look, researchers into this case, they spend so much time and effort and, you know, frankly, a good portion of their lives looking into this stuff. And wouldn't it be great to be the guy who solved the case? You know, I'm sure every researcher out there has thought that, you know, well, any conspiracy person looking into anything has thought, you know, wouldn't it be great if I was the one to actually find out what happened?
Be a pretty dangerous, dangerous situation to find oneself in as well, too. Unless you shared that knowledge quickly and got it out there so that other people were, you know, it's like your life insurance policy. As is the case with what happened with Dorothy Kilgallen. Look at how that all, you know, kind of went down. So just another coincidence. And we didn't get into the body count either. That whole end of thing, the kill list. Who was it? The comedian, with this, the name's not coming to mind.
Richard Belzer.
There you go. And so, yeah, he put out the famous kill list, book, and, there's been a lot said about that. What do you think though, just quick, because there's so many issues here that we could, tackle and kind of delve into. It's no wonder you've done 150 plus shows. You know, I'm not sure what the number is now. It's, but you could go on forever with this, of course. And, it's just such, there's just so much to discuss. But just regarding the kill list in particular, what do you think? Coincidence, or is it beyond probability?
Well, you know, there's before Belzer, before Richard Sharnan, who's another guy that's out there that's a proponent of this kill list. You know, you got to go all the way back, you know, to even the 60s and 70s when people were dying under mysterious circumstances, or so they thought. You know, even in the I forget what the movie was called that they did about the assassination in I think it was 1974. You know, it was a major motion picture. Oh man, it's escaping me. If anybody knows out there,
let me just quickly. I'll give
executive action. That's what it was.
Yeah, let me just give you a second to collect your thought and executive action. I think I know the movie you're talking about, but there are people that are wondering, just asking who it is that our guest is today. It is Rob Clark from the Lone Gunman podcast. I'd hope that we'd made that clear enough over the course of today's discussion, but apparently a few people kind of missed out on that information, so that's fine. But just to revisit and recap, we're kind of trying to wind things down here, just a few minutes past the hour and a half that we generally allocate for a discussion. But yeah, quickly, if you could just summarize and wrap up on this executive action movie.
Well, there was a graphic there at the end of the movie, and the movie was loosely based on the events of the assassination. And it was a big Hollywood production. At the very end of the movie, they had a graphics card come up, and it kind of really intrigued a lot of people. You know, it kind of, I forget exactly what it said, but it kind of, alluded to the fact that there was, like, you know, hundreds of unsolved related deaths to the Kennedy assassination. Well, when they traced this graphic back to some newspaper in England that had come up with this thing, a lot of them are very tenuous. You know, and Penn Jones, who was original first generation researcher, and you know, he was big on these assassination related deaths as well. And I do think there's something to it. And like I said, in the recent years, Richard Belzer's wrote a book called The Hit List. And when you really look at the laundry list of names that are closely associated to the conversation, not like, you know, Jack Ruby's brother's cousin's, you know, second daughter or what, you know, whatever. When you look at the people that are closely associated, like David Ferry, for instance, you know, I think there's something up with his death. You know, and Lee Bowers, who was died under mysterious circumstances. Well, he was a guy in the tower there,
George,
in the rail yard.
George de Morenschild, who apparently he was set to testify before the House Select Committee on Assassinations, correct? And he just apparently just put a bullet in his head, and with that kind of, and that was right on the heels of his reaching out, as I recall, to George H.W. Bush, who may at that time he was heavily, you know, he had some, you know, some very intimate connection, working in some capacity with the CIA. So, apparently was rebuffed and snubbed, and he would not didn't want anything to do with his old friend. So they were apparently quite chummy for a time, at least. But yeah,
I think the guy was knocking on his door or heading up his driveway to knock on his door, and he hears gunshots. Now, what's a funny thing about this is Bill O'Reilly, in recent years, in his book Killing Kennedy, claims that he was there.
Whoa!
Morenschild's doorstep.
Gunshots or just one single shot?
Well, one gunshot.
I see. Okay,
It was actually Gaten Fonzie though that was there, not Bill O'Reilly. I don't know why he told that story,
Bullshit artist. I mean, just as you say earlier, what these people that try to insert themselves into the narrative and you find it too, like the world, the ufology, and all kinds of different characters that just, you know, for, you know, whatever reason, they want to. I guess they're 15 minutes of fame. So, and that's just, I'm just speaking in very general terms now too, of course. I'm not pointing any fingers. I'm just, you know, speaking, just, you know, talking about how, as you've pointed out, how things tip.
Yeah, well, that guy, he's turned the assassination, well, even of Kennedy and Lincoln. Now it's, you know, into a cottage industry, killing Jesus, killing Hitler, you know, whatever other books he's written. But, you know, this guy, he used to do good work. When he was with the Current Affair, they would run, you know, pretty gripping news stories that nobody else was really talking about in regards to the assassination. You know, and now he's this high, you know, mightier than thou, you know, Fox News correspondent who's a big lone nutter, who is Oswald's guilty, this, that, and the other. And anybody that believes different is an idiot.
So, and what do you think then? That's probably the last question I guess we'll ask you. There's a lot of other items that we could hit on here, but we just don't have the time. Was Oswald, people in the people that have joined us here today for today's show, they want to know, was he a patsy? Do you believe that Oswald was a patsy or not, or maybe even more than a patsy? What's your exact position? Where do you stand?
Well, I flip-flop. Depending on what day you ask me. And the reason I say that is because there's always some new information coming out. There's always things we don't know yet. We don't know the whole truth yet, really, to be honest with you. And, you know, I used to believe that Oswald was a patsy and he was set up and he had no knowledge whatsoever of anything. And more recently, I think he may have knew something. I still don't put him up on the sixth floor shooting at the president. But when it comes to recent testimony, I guess, that's come out, that a guy by the name of Beale Frazier has said, who was the guy that took him to work that day, and some things that I've put together with that, I come up with a little bit of a different take on things. So, you know, there's new stuff coming out all the time, and, you know, you really got to stay on top of things and be vigilant and always be willing to, you know, change your views in light of new evidence. I think if you don't, you're not really being honest with yourself.
Tough, of course, to make the distinction between what some may want to have us believe is new evidence and, on the other hand, just flat-out disinformation. But just as far as now Oswald and his role in things goes, what about the whole business of J.D. Tippit? Do you think that he actually shot him, or was that just another, he was framed for that as well?
Personally, I believe, that Jack Ruby's barman, Larry Crayford, is the one that killed J.D. Tippit.
And why?
But that's a whole another hour long show.
Yeah, because Oswald was in the theater. Watching this movie, I guess, wasn't it like a John Ford picture, and had a bucket of popcorn there, and he'd been
Yeah, Van Heflin, Cry of War, and I mean, there's even questions of whether or not it was actually Oswald staying at the rooming house on Beckley Street. You know, he supposedly was staying there under an alias, O.H. Lee, but he was in a different rooming house before he moved into that one under his real name, Lee, you know, H. Oswald. So why would he all of a sudden want to live, you know, move a week after he's moved into a rooming house and move into another one using a false name? You know, and this guy, Larry Crayford, that I'm talking about here, very much resembled Oswald. He's responsible for a lot of the Jack Ruby and Lee Oswald together sightings, as a matter of fact. And allegedly stayed in a closet in the Carousel Club, which worked for Jack Ruby for free for several months. Well, about a month and a half before the assassination. This fella, I believe it was the morning after the assassination, he skated. He was like, I'm out of here. See you later. Now, the FBI tracked him down to Michigan, of all places, where his sister lived. And, you know, he kind of got lost to history. He changed one letter in his last name, and the HSCA could not find him to question him because of the, you know, he changed one letter in his last name. And he's a fascinating guy, and
he's got
a story to tell for sure.
Yeah, I mean, there's once again so much to get into here, but just quickly, wasn't there a lady, as she was portrayed, I guess, we saw her portrayed in the movie that Oliver Stone put out, she was thrown out of the vehicle, I think is what it was, and she was all beat and battered up, and she was kind of going on about how they're going to kill the president, and I'm not sure if this is supposed to be the same character who in real life was a guy. There's another character who went and shot up a bank just for no reason, just because I guess he wanted to get arrested and locked up, so he felt that'd be the safest place to be. Do you know about those two characters? What I'm kind of getting
I do. Yeah. Now, the second one is a fellow by the name of Richard Case Nagel, and he's the subject of a very big book by Dick Russell called The Man Who Knew Too Much. And, yeah, you're absolutely right. He went into a bank in September or October of 1963. And shot a couple holes in the ceiling and went out and sat on the curb and waited for the cops to get there. And he was arrested. And, you know, the reason he gave for this is he stated, you know, he wanted to be in jail. And he told this pretty fantastic story about how he was a double agent, for Russia and the United States. And then he was tasked to kill Lee Oswald. And that he knew something was going to happen and, he didn't want to be a part of it. And he ultimately did not choose to kill Lee Oswald or be anywhere near Dallas at the time this thing was supposed to go down. But once again, it's a story, you know, an interesting one for sure. And I would recommend everybody read that book. It's fascinating. But, you know, once again, no proof. You know, he was one of these guys that had a dead man switch. Allegedly that, you know, when he died or if he was caught or anything like this, that there would be proof released of what he was saying, and nothing ever came. But the other lady you're referring to is Rose Sheremy, and that did happen. The opening scene of JFK, where she's pushed down into the road. She was allegedly on her way to Dallas with a couple of fellas who were going to kill the president. Or at least talking about doing it or being associated with it somehow. And she was taken to the hospital and, you know, she started saying these things that they're going to kill the president. They're going to kill the president. And they have interviewed, the doctors and nurses there. And it's a true story. She did have some kind of foreknowledge of the event. Pretty fascinating stuff. Her son, Michael Mercedes, recently, wrote a book about his mother. And there's another book called A Rose by Any Other Name that's also out there, written by another fella, that tells her story as well, if anybody would like to check into it.
As far as the arrest of the character who went into the bank and shot a couple holes in the roof, there are no records to be found whatsoever. Completely just does not exist. Is that right?
Well, I mean, that event did happen, and he did go to jail. But this fellow... He was a veteran, and he had mental problems. He had survived a plane crash. He had survived getting shot in the chest at point-blank range. He survived being in the war. and he did have some mental issues. As far as any proof of what he was saying, as far as being some kind of CIA agent or having ties to the CIA and the KGB, there's no records of that. No, but the bank incident did happen. Okay. But he didn't say beforehand that this is why he's doing it. It was only after the fact that I did it because I knew what was going to happen and I didn't want to be associated with it.
Okay. Well, thanks for your time, Rob. This has been great. I mean, we've gone a little bit over the allocated limit as we typically we set aside here to do the show. The one thing that we did not do, though, unfortunately, and it kind of got putting the cart before the horse here, but usually I'm not even sure where we conducted this interview, if we were on the Robin Hood today or not, but maybe let's see if Pirate Larry can come on, kind of interject here. And Larry, can you hear us? Or I'm not sure if he's still there or not, but we didn't do a pirate story.
We got told a pirate story in the green room. Yeah, we were confused by the pirate story we heard in the green room.
Right.
But was a pirate story. For the sake of the audience, we should tell the pirate story.
We should revisit that. Rob, if you don't mind, let's hear your pirate story one more time just so we can ensure that we've received the captain's blessing.
Well, I don't know if it's a pirate story directly related to pirating, but it's the closest thing that I've ever been to as far as being associated with pirates. I mean, I don't get out much. I'm over here in Virginia. not exactly pirate country, but I did have relations with a lady who wore an eye patch and liked to talk like a pirate.
Was it a glass eye?
No, there was nothing there at all.
Oh.
Just a patch. Yeah.
She had no eye.
She had no eye.
Well, how about that?
An empty socket.
How were her legs? She had both legs?
No peg legs. She had two good legs.
No parrots?
The rest of her body was just fine. It's just I believe she lost her eye in an accident as a child and preferred to
pirate
wear a peg.
Wench.
Yeah.
Joined the pirate.
Bonafide.
Yeah.
Bonafide pirate wench.
Bonafide.
So, although you wouldn't want to necessarily refer to her in that way to her face, because there have been known through history to be quite a few women who they could handle themselves quite well around swords, cutlasses, muskets, those sort of things. So yeah, you'd have to watch your step, definitely. But thanks once again, Rob. You've got you can be reached via it's LTR. Lone, how is your podcast? How's the URL read again?
It's TLG, like for the Lone Gunman. TLGpodcast.com.
Mm-hmm.
People can find me on Facebook and Twitter as well.
We don't have your Twitter information. Maybe we can get that after the show here. But are you going to be able to join us in the Rogues Gallery? I'm not sure. Virginia, gosh, what time it is. It could be getting into the wee hours now, but there is a few people that looks like we got a number here in the YouTube chat area, and a few that would like to join us there in the backstage.
Yeah, I'd be happy to stick around, man.
All right, so much appreciated. We're gonna close now with the famous JFK, the secret society speech that we had talked about earlier, and look forward to meeting everyone in the backstage area.
Ladies and gentlemen, the very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. No president should fear public scrutiny of his program, for from that scrutiny comes understanding, and from that understanding comes support or opposition, and both are necessary. I am not asking your newspapers to support an administration, but I am asking your help in the tremendous task of informing and alerting the American people. For I have complete confidence. And the response and dedication of our citizens whenever they are fully informed. I not only could not stifle controversy among your readers, I welcome it. This administration intends to be candid about its errors. For as a wise man once said, an error doesn't become a mistake until you refuse to correct it. We intend to accept full responsibility for our errors, and we expect you to point them out when we miss them. Without debate, without criticism, no administration and no country can succeed, and no republic can survive. That is why the Athenian lawmaker Solon decreed it a crime for any citizen to shrink from controversy. And that is why our press was protected by the First Amendment, the only business in America specifically protected by the Constitution, not primarily to amuse and entertain, not to emphasize the trivial and the sentimental, not to simply give the public what it wants, but to inform, to arouse, to reflect, to state our dangers and our opportunities, to indicate our crises and our choices, to lead, mold, educate, and sometimes even anger public opinion. This means greater coverage and analysis of international news. For it is no longer far away and foreign, but close at hand and local. It means greater attention to improved understanding of the news, as well as improved transmission. And it means, finally, that government at all levels must meet its obligation to provide you with the fullest possible information outside the narrowest limits of national security. And so it is to the printing press, to the recorder of man's deeds, the keeper of his conscience, the courier of his news, that we look for strength and assistance, confident that with your help, man will be what he was born to be, free and independent.